Welcome to The Buzz, Studio W, The Buzz, your global radio network. You guys know we circle this thing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with the finest in broadcasting you can find anywhere around the globe. Avid listeners, you already know what this program is all about. For those who are just joining us for the first time, Groove Swing Speaks. We try to bring and showcase the best in our community. We go back and we give you historical facts and figures and things like that, and we do our best to relate that to our audience. Guys, so thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate that. So tell a friend, you have time. In the next hour or so, we have a special guest, and that's Dr. Wendell C. Fuller. Now, we always like to tie in with our guests. We like to tie in the community and also the history along with our guests, okay? We try to make that interesting. I'll tell you a little bit more about Dr. Fuller in a second. Let me see if I can get YouTube, Facebook hooked up for you. But anyway, I want to bring to the set one of our panelists, Robert Hicks. Hey, Brother Hicks, what's going on?
Everything is everything. Good evening, WB. Good evening, Dr. Fuller. Thank you for being here this evening. And definitely appreciate everybody tuning in tonight. You're in for a treat this evening because of the special guest that we have today. I can't say enough about him. He's a very good brother, a fellow of Groove, fine groove, but definitely he cares about the people. So I just wanted to invite you to just stick around for a while and just have a good time and listen to this brother. He has a lot to drop knowledge on you.
Absolutely. We have a few other panelists going to join us. And I'm really sure Tanisha was on. I think she's having a little technical difficulties. Sergeant Clayton Brown, our groove brother, he will also join us as well. And Tiffany Hilliard, she's our sister Nakaya Watts. She's out on assignment today. She's going to be missed greatly. So anyway, guys, hey, Dr. Fuller, how are you, sir?
Yes, I'm doing blessed, man. Doing blessed. Pretty busy day. You know, we had a snow day here in Virginia, so they let us go a little early. You know, our superintendent's from Chicago, so she didn't see the need to close school. So, little snow didn't stop her. And then we actually are rechartering the, Prince William chapter of National Association of Black School Educators. So right before I'm on this call, we were doing the bylaws and everything like that. So it's been a pretty busy day, but I definitely wanted to make time for this. I'm a big fan, and I'm honored to be here.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. What I'm going to do, I'm going to start this thing off because, like I said, we try our best to link some black history to our guests, right? Whether it's education, whether it's medicine, it could be business, because we have made major, major contributions to this country and the world, and I think it should be duly noted. And so I'm going to kick this off, and I'm going to talk about someone that you told me that you were a fan of and one of the people, one of our history makers that inspired you, and that's none other than Booker T. Washington. He was an author, educator, orator, philanthropist, and from 1895 until his death in 1915, short-lived, the United States' most famous African-American. That little tiny school you guys know down in Alabama, Tuskegee Institute, that currently enrolls more than 3,000 students. He was the founder of Tuskegee Institute, building it into one of the premier universities for African Americans at a time when few alternatives were available, and he raised considerable funds for hundreds of other schools in the South for black people. Let's see, there's Tanisha right there. Hey, Tanisha.
Hey, everyone. Hola.
Okay, Tanisha, I want you to meet Dr. Fuller. And okay. I'm talking about, since he is an educator and okay. one of, someone who inspired him, I thought it'd be a great idea, to talk about, some people that he told me that inspired him. Okay. And I was just talking about, Dr., Booker T. Washington.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And there are two others we want to talk about. Robert is going to talk about, I believe, Carter G. Woodson. And what I'd like for you. No, I did Booker T. Washington. I'm sorry. I took your spot there.
You did?
I sure did. I tell you what. Pull up Carter G. Woodson, and I'm going to Robert next.
Okay, you're going to pull up who, Wilson?
Carter G. Woodson. Carter G. Woodson. Okay.
Just checking you off, okay?
Yes. And Robert, W.E.B. Du Bois, what do you have on him?
Well, what is there not to say about him? I'll go into rare detail because he is definitely one of the intellectuals of our intellectuals, basically, that we've learned Black history. For W.E.B. Du Bois was the first Black American to earn a PhD from Harvard University back in 1895. And you think about the time frame, basically during the turn of the century, when it came down to African Americans, when it came down to education.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, W.E.B. Du Bois was born in Massachusetts. And basically, he has became one of the most influential people when it came down to understanding of African-American rights. And he became an African-American activist during the early 20th century. One of the things that you know from W.E.B. Du Bois is his focus on informing our community about the ills of society, which is where he formed the book, which is called The Crisis in 1910. And it's also W.E.B. Du Bois was part of the NAACP. It was one of the co-founders of the NAACP. One of the things that was interesting about W.E.B. Du Bois was that being able to challenge people on who they are individually as people. One of his notes when it came down to his seminal work, which is called The Souls of Black Folk in 1903, once again, turn of the century, but very important to note that he mentions the predicament of Black Americans as one of double consciousness. Now, what does that mean? That basically means there are two individuals inside of one person. W.E.B. Du Bois puts it this way, quote, "One ever feels his two-ness. An American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder." This term, double consciousness, has come to be widely used as a theoretical frame to apply to other dynamics of inequality. In this society, even today, Black men have came across the sense of having basically being two people, the person being living here in America, but at the same time knowing who they are as Black people and having to fight in this country. Interestingly enough, also within the monthly magazine, The Crisis, W.E.B. Du Bois was able to address a lot of the outlawed lynchings that took place in the turn of the century. In a 1915 article, he mentioned in there a list of over the past three decades, from the 1885 to 1915, basically over 2,700 lynchings that took place in this country. A stark reality of the history of this country, but its reality. And one thing I also knew, interesting, did a little research on W.E.B. Du Bois, was the fact that he actually ran for U.S. Senate back in 1950 in the state of New York. He ran under the American Labor Party in 1950, and actually came away with about 206,000 votes. So knowing that he had a presence throughout society, he was very amazing in regards to being able to run for Senate. But one of the other things that W.E.B. Du Bois was very passionate about was Pan-Africanism.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that who we are as individuals here, but also having our ties back to the motherland, as well as throughout the Caribbean as well. And for the last portion of years of his life, W.E.B. Du Bois actually traveled back to and became a citizen in Ghana. So he basically lived up to his words and his teachings by traveling back home to the motherland. What I find kind of interesting also was the date that he died. W.E.B. Du Bois passed away on August 27th, 1963. The day before the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in Washington, D.C., and the day before Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech.
Wow.
That was telling in itself. Mm-hmm. But knowing that everything that W.E.B. Du Bois stood for throughout the years eventually came to a head in a sense of the continuation through a lot of leaders, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and as we continue to still do today.
Wow. So, interesting.
And I'll leave with one quote, if you don't mind, but also it's an interesting note. And it's about telling times as it is here today. One of W.E.B. Du Bois' quotes was, "Either America will destroy ignorance, or ignorance will destroy the United States."
Wow. How true is that? How true is that? Hey, welcome to said another one of our Groove Brothers, a panelist, Mark Daniels. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
Doing well, doing well. I don't know whether you met our Groove Brother, Dr. Wendell.
No, I have not.
Okay. Wendell C. Fuller.
Hey, Mark. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm feeling blessed, man.
Oh, great, great, great.
Yeah.
For some, we lost Tanisha, so this is what I'm going to do. Carter G. Woodson was an American historian who first opened the long neglected field of African and African-American history to scholars and popularized the field in schools and colleges across the United States. Let's see. His famous book. Let's talk about his famous book. He wrote more than a dozen books over the course of his career, most notably The MIS-Education of the Negro in 1933, with his focus on Western indoctrination. Okay. Perhaps Tanisha has it right there. Carter G. Woodson. What do you have?
So I'm going to just base off, because this is impromptu for me, because I was actually ready for W.T. Booker. I had it all down packed, so I'm just going to give you a brief overview.
Okay.
Okay.
That's fine.
All right, so I'm going to go in between the studio, so hold on just a second, okay?
Okay, no problem.
All right, can you all hear me okay?
We can hear you.
All right. So Carter Goodwin Woodson was born in December 19th, 1875, and he actually died April 3rd, 1950. Hmm. He actually was an American historian, a journalist, and a founder of the Association for Studies of African American Life and History. So I can understand why he's by this, by him. He was one of the first scholars to history of African diaspora, including African American history, and the founder and the Journal of Negro History in 1916. Woodson has been called the father of black history.
Mm-hmm.
Are you all following?
Loud and clear.
Okay. All right. So, of course, as you may know, he's the father of black history. He also was celebrated and launched a newspaper or journal back in 1926, back in February, called the Negro History Week, and was also the precursor of the Black History Month. Woodson was an important figure for the to the movement of Afrocentrism due to his perspective of placing people of African descent at the center of the study of history and the human experience. So, this is my quick impromptu notice of this too, right here. So I didn't do much research. I had Booker T. Washington. That's what I was told to do.
You did.
But, I'm sorry, I had to jump into this. and run up the steps.
You know, Tanisha, teaching is a lot like that. You know, like some days you'll be in the classroom and, you know, you got your lesson plan all straightened out, and then the projector screen goes out and you got to, or the internet goes down and you got to figure it out. So, you know, I'm impressed with the resourcefulness.
Yeah. You did fine. And now let's talk about our guest, Dr. Wendell C. Fuller. Currently serves as a special educator and administrator designee in Prince William County Schools. He is also an associate professor of education at Northern Virginia Community College. His education includes a Bachelor of Science in Communications from Boise State University, a Master of Arts in Leadership and Teaching Special Education from Notre Dame of Maryland University, and an Education Specialist degree in Curriculum and Instruction Special Education from Liberty University. He earned a Doctorate of Education in Curriculum and Instruction Special Education from Liberty University. Previously, Wendell served as a special educator in Prince George's Public Schools. Wendell's 20 years of experience in special education has allowed him to develop numerous individualized education plans for students from all disability categories, and develop instructional and behavior management strategies for students from every grade level and demographic. Wendell has also served as PBIS. What is PBIS, Wendell?
PBIS is Positive Behavior Intervention and Support. It's a behavior intervention system that is school-wide that basically catches the kids doing good instead of always, you know, kicking them in the neck, basically.
Right, right. Instead of focusing on the negative.
Yeah. Instead of focusing on the negative, focus on the positive. Right?
Absolutely. I'd love that. A PBS committee chair and a school climate and culture committee chair, where he developed behavior and discipline frameworks for several school sites. As a professor, he specializes in courses focused on training new and aspiring teachers and guiding them towards initial educator certification in Virginia. In Virginia, rather. Wendell is a family man and a man of faith. He and his wife, Stephanie, have three children, Wendell Jr., and your daughter, is that Aaliyah or Laya?
Aaliyah
and Timothy. Aaliyah. He also serves as the Islamic chaplain at Fauquier Health in Warrenton?
Fauquier Health
in Warrenton, Virginia, and is the past president of both the Bowie State and Prince George's County graduate chapters of Groove 5 Groove Social Fellowship Incorporated. He and his family live on the family homestead in Warrenton, Virginia. Hey, welcome to the set, Dr. Fuller. Man, we've got a lot to unpack here. I want to start off with, Tanisha. Tanisha, what questions do you have for Dr. Fuller?
So I like the fact that he has the abbreviations for positive reinforcement, you know, as far as like you're basically, you know, pointing out positive reinforcement. So what made you come up with that? Because so often people actually always scold for negative reinforcement, negative behavior versus positive reinforcement. So what made you come up with that?
Well, I didn't come up with it. It's a nationwide program. Mm-hmm. I can't take credit for it. If I did, I'd be a lot richer than what I am right now. You know, I wouldn't be teaching if I came up with that. But, you know, PBIS, what drew me to PBIS is that my first couple years of teaching, actually my first job in teaching, I was a substitute teacher at an elementary school, and they basically had me working with a little boy. I'm not going to say his name, but they had me working with a little boy who was very, very emotionally disabled. He was sick, and he was pulling out scissors, and he was pulling girls' hair, calling them the B word. He was in the first grade. He was wilding. And it was a little short Jewish lady. I think her name was Bernstein, but I'm not really sure. I don't remember her name too well because it was a while ago. But She basically said, just tell him when he's doing good, right? Tell him when he's doing good. And, you know, don't chastise him as much as, because what I was doing was like, stop. Don't do this. Don't do that. And she's like, just be positive with him. And when I started my master's program, I realized that there was a theoretical framework to this. When I got to my first certified real teaching job, I worked in a program with kids with emotional disabilities, basically an alternative school, and I needed some, just for my peace of mind, I needed a way to get along with these kids, because if I didn't get along with them, somebody was going to get hurt. And I'm not saying that like I would hit them. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that they were throwing chairs. They would pull out pencils, stab each other. You know, every day was a karate class if it wasn't a safe situation. So I realized, through my reading and learning about PBIS and also through experience, that if I can connect with them on a positive level, if I can catch them doing good, that the relationships that we build and that we catching them doing good, that school is a positive thing for them. And I'm a positive, when they're triggered in a positive way when they come to my classroom as opposed to being negative. And that's a big part of the problem that kids have in school, why they tune out, because from kindergarten and pre-K, oh, stop beating on the table, stop running around, stop doing this, stop doing that. And they believe that school is not welcoming for them. So that's kind of where I started at and why I spent so much time researching it.
So is it kind of similar to, like, I kind of look at it as like similar to, like, is it called CBT or something like that? Similar to
Cognitive behavior therapy. Yeah. It's similar to it.
Okay.
It's basically positive reinforcement, right? Okay. So the way PBIS works is, you know, we'll have a token economy, basically. Mm-hmm. We'll have,
okay,
it'll be Tiger Bucks, it'll be, you know, Bulldog, you know, Tiger Dollars, Bulldog Bucks, you know, Kenmore Cash, or, you know, whatever the school, you come up with a catchy name for it.
Mm-hmm.
And when the kids are behaving positively,
mm-hmm,
you provide them something from this token economy. You give them, you know, 5 Tiger Bucks for walking in line. You give them 2 Tiger Bucks for throwing their trash away correctly. You give them 10 Tiger Bucks for answering a question, you know, attempting to answer a question in class. And then they can then cash in those Tiger Bucks for incentives in the school, whether it's a dance, ice cream social. You give them, you know, perfect attendance is a big thing at the school I'm at now. You know, when kids get perfect attendance, you know, we put them in a raffle for Chick-fil-A cards and things like that. So
that's pretty cool.
Trying to incentivize the positive behavior as opposed to always focusing on the negative reinforcement.
So I'm kind of curious with my last question. So what I'm kind of curious about the outcome. I'm going to call him Nick Cannon because you said he was wilding out. So the question, what is the outcome of the child that you did this reinforcement with?
Well, it was a total package. So
okay.
The assistant principal there, she was a school psychologist before she became an assistant principal, and she was a very strong Christian sister. So
okay.
We recognized that it was really a lot of it was family issue. Mom and dad
Right.
broke up, and there was child support and custody involved, and he wanted to be with his daddy. So what I did was two things. Was I kind of mediated with his mother, where I was like, you know, stop treating his father like that. Like, he's trying to be involved. He's coming up to the school. You're not helping yourself by pushing him away. You're hurting your child. And because I had built that relationship with her, She was a little younger than me, about my age. We were able to build kind of a rapport. She took that and she tried it. You know, she tried to include him. And I also encouraged his mother to take him to a doctor. Now, you know, this is a whole nother conversation. We'll probably do a whole nother show on this. But most Black children, when they have mental health problems, we don't take them to the doctor. We take them to
church.
No, we take them to church and we lay hands on them and we try to exorcise the demons. Mm-hmm. We call Uncle Junebug to beat them up. You know, we put them out. You know, we take their TV, take their phone. You know, we don't take them to the doctor. Little Johnny, you know, when the white kid gets sick, as soon as he starts talking crazy, that's the first place they go. So they have a whole different set of outcomes when it comes to black kids and mental health. So I encourage his mom to seek treatment, and he got treatment. It's a long process when you go through something like that. When you know, there's trial and error, but eventually he graduated. He went to college. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I haven't talked to him in about maybe 4 years, but he had just graduated high school and was on his way to Prince George's Community College.
Awesome.
Okay. Amazing. You know, we're getting a lot of great comments here. And because Emma Brown, she wanted to know, does anyone know why was the month of February chosen for Black History Month? And Rock just put this up, and Dr. Fuller, is what the Rock says. Woodson chose February for the reasons of tradition and reform. It's commonly said that Woodson selected February to encompass the birthdays of two great Americans who played a prominent role in shaping Black history, namely Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, whose birthdays are the 12th and the 14th, respectively. More importantly, he chose them for reasons of tradition. Since Lincoln's assassination in 1865, the Black community, along with other Republicans, had celebrating. Okay, I don't. That is cut off right there. Would you like to compliment on that?
Yeah. So, brother. I think it's a trope. It's kind of a trope that we kind of tell on ourselves that Black History Month is in February because it's the shortest month. We tell ourselves that, maybe there's reasons why we are distrustful, or not maybe, there are reasons why we should be distrustful of whatever the government sanctions or, you know, what have you. You know, we've been lied to a lot, but at the end of the day, that is the correct reason, because Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass's birthdays are in that month. Carter G. Woodson decided to use February, and that was also the week of Negro History Week, when he founded Negro History Week, and Negro History Week eventually was able to expand to an entire month, specifically during the Civil Rights Movement, as Martin Luther King was able to kind of use, you know, their own scripture and their own ethics to really convict the soul of white America and say, hey, we've done wrong. So when they realized that, it just like after George Floyd, you know, organizations got a lot of money and a lot of attention from white businesses and the government and things like that. The same thing happened after the March on Washington, and specifically the death of Martin Luther King, where white society realized, at least to whatever degree, I mean, they may not ever get it, right? We got to be prepared for that, that they may not ever want us to be with their daughter or at their country club. They may not ever want that, but at the end of the day, we made some progress because of his death, and unfortunately, it took that to expand it as much as it has been over the years.
I have some more questions, but I'm going to toss this over to Mark. Mark, I'm sure you have some questions for Dr. Fuller.
Yeah, one of the questions I would have, just out of curiosity, when you were saying, you know, the black families and how they handle this, is a lot of times the thing I hear when you see children that are having issues like that is the family goes into denial a lot of times and say, oh, there's nothing wrong with them. They'll grow up out of it. His aunt or uncle or his brother, whoever was like that. Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with that when they're pushing back, when you're trying to lead them in a direction of getting help?
Well, I'm on YouTube and, you know, this is public, but we among family, right? So I've been through this myself, right, with mental health. You know, when I was, 15, 16, 17, specifically after, you know, my first semester of college, you know, I smoked a little too much weed, right? And it really affected my mental health. I mean, dramatically. Like, I went from, you know, straight edge, ROTC, SGA president to, like, basically bumming around. And, you know, my father, out of everybody in my family, I've dealt with this. My mother, oh, he's just a bad seed. Let him go. Put him out. My own mother. I love my mother, right? But, you know, she was very hurt, didn't know how to handle it. My aunts, I come from a very diverse family religiously, so my Christian aunts were kind of like, hey, you know, you need to take him to church and get him in Bible study and get him in Turning Point or, you know, some kind of program. My Muslim aunts were saying, don't trust the doctors because, you know, they're going to poison him and they're going to make him sick. But my dad, and I'm hoping he's watching, my dad, out of everybody in my life, said, no, my son is sick. This is a medical issue. And he forced me, literally, went to the judge. You know, he's a Mason, so he went and did the Grand Haven sign or whatever and got the judge to send the sheriff and take me to the hospital. And he did that about four or five times until I figured it out. And once I said, okay, I'll try this. I'm going to take my medication. I mean, it's like a clear line right here between the day before and the day after, where the day before I was a college dropout, you know, criminally involved, so on and so forth, to now here I am 20, 30 years, 35 years later where, you know, I got kids, I got property, I got a doctorate, I got, you know, all this other kind of stuff. So it's not a magic bullet. There's other things that go involved with it, but that's how I personally tell the story. I tell my own story in those IEP meetings with those families. When I first started teaching, I was very cautious about that. I was, you know, even my dad would tell me, hey, people don't need to know all that about you. But the further and further I got away from the dark space, the more I wanted to shine light on it. And the other thing is just helping people understand, you know, we're talking about Black History Month, you know, biological psychiatry or chemical psychiatry is an African science. It's not, you know, these European scientists didn't know anything about it until they raided the tombs in Kemet. You know, Dr. Naeem Akbar, who is one of the world's most renowned psychologists, he wrote a whole book on this, The African Origin of Biological Psychiatry, where Egyptians, you know, they had brain surgery. They knew about the neurotransmitters, dopamine and serotonin, and they were actually chemically altering them with different chemicals so that people could live adjusted lives. So this is our science. We originated it, and it's not something, as much as there's problems in it, and it's a give and take as to the side effects and things like that, but at the end of the day, this is something that we need to reclaim for our own. And, you know, I was blessed with Black doctors, with Muslim doctors, with Christian doctors, with Black counselors and things like that. And, you know, and Black teachers, you know, HBCUs, you know, being at HBCU made a big difference because I had people that understood the necessity of getting the help. So that's basically how I did it. I said a lot, but it's something that's real personal to me. So
I find it a fascinating story myself. Let me ask you a question, because how do you, when say you're given a lecture or you're teaching a class, do you find that when you are telling your story, the children can relate to it more than if you're talking about someone else?
You know, yes and no. You know, kids are mean. Kids are very mean, right? So you have to be very, it's a teaching is an art and it's a science. It's like you kind of have to balance between those two. So you have to know when is the right space and the right time to have that conversation. When I do share this conversation, it's because I know I'm in a safe space. And I know that it's something that's going to impact the kids. I know it's something that's going to help them. But to your question, do they relate better with me versus hearing about somebody else? That's definitely, especially for our black students, black boys specifically, because they don't have anybody that looks like them, that speaks their language, that knows the handshake, that's able to have that conversation with them. Wow. Most times when I have the conversation, it's with those students. Mm-hmm. You know, white students, I have to, you know, but specifically the boys, when I have these conversations, you know, it's a manhood issue. And when we have those conversations about a manhood issue, their ears go up, you know, they hear it, you know, just like a little wolf. You know, they're like, oh, it's an antenna that they hear. It's an antenna that they react to. Yeah.
Welcome to the set, our sister Tiffany. Hey, Tiff.
Hello, everyone. Greetings and hola, my sister.
Hola.
Yeah. I do apologize for being late. Just got home from work. But nevertheless, I'm here.
That's quite all right. What questions do you have for Dr. Fuller?
This is my first time meeting you. So hello, sir. How are
hello,
you?
Hello. Hey, how's everybody?
Good. So I did read your bio, and I'm pretty sure you probably already went over this, at the beginning, but my question is, what made you go into this particular field?
Well, two things. I'm certified in history, and I'm also certified in special education. I got my love for history, as a very young man. It started off with military history. I was into, you know, I had all the ranks on my wall, and I would sit and watch, you know, History Channel about World War II and World War I and Korea and Civil War and stuff. You know, I was always into that when I was a kid, but it really got solidified in fifth grade that I wanted to really do something in government, politics, history. My fifth grade teacher, Miss Noor, I don't know that I can really put my finger on what she did or what she said, but she fed my love for civics and history and government. And when she realized, so I remember the Berlin Wall had just come down. I was in the fifth grade. And she said, I want everybody to make predictions about what's going to happen after the Berlin Wall came down. And everybody was saying, oh, you know, Germany's going to fight. They were coming to all these things. And I raised my hand, only black in the class. I said, East and West Germany are going to reunify. And she stopped and she said, nah, that's not going to happen. I said, mark my words, they're going to reunify. Mm-hmm. And before I left in sixth grade, this was in fifth grade, the next year, I guess a year and a half later, they had reunified. Mm-hmm. And she said, you got it. You know, she patted me on the back. She's like, you called it. So that just kind of solidified. As far as special ed, again, working with that one student, my own experience, first and foremost, was part of the reason why I wanted to do SPED. But then working with that student, that first grader, when I first started out, as a sub, really solidified my confidence that I could do this. And then the last reason was because I knew I would always have a job. It was one of the reasons why I got into SPED, because they told me they were paying for the SPED certification, they were paying for the master's. And as a SPED teacher, and I tell all the people who are interested in being educators, get certified in ESOL or get certified in SPED. Because if you do, you are always the last person let go, because there's such a need for that. And last thing I'll say is that most of the kids in SPED are black boys. And I knew that was a focus for me. And I wanted to be around those kids who really needed the help, because a lot of them are in SPED because of family issues, not because there's something biologically wrong with them. And I knew in that space, Uncle Wendell would be effective.
Great. What does those acronyms mean? ESOL and SPED. What does that stand for?
SPED is special education, and ESOL is English speakers or English for speakers of other languages. Mm-hmm. So basically for people teaching students that that are coming from other countries that don't speak English.
Before I go to Mark, I find your approach to education and your approach to teaching fascinating. Do you find, what I find when I'm speaking to people is that the more positive affirmations you can give, and especially if you find that this particular child is labeled a troubled child, do you find that it could be because they've always been fed negative information? And do you find that with your approach with PBIS that it changes the game?
Exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, I don't read, I purposely don't read the paperwork when I get new students. I don't read it. I don't read it. I mean, I probably get myself in trouble if my boss hears me say this, but I don't read the IEP. I don't, you know, I probably do that. Like if school starts in August, unless the IEP is getting ready to come due, I'll read the accommodations and modifications I need to make, mm-hmm. you know, like at a glance, but I'm not going to ingest all of the disability and deficiencies that these students have. Unless there's something really, like, I really need to understand what's going on with this kid. Mm-hmm. But most of these little boys, they just kids. Kids right. have not changed. They're the right. same as they were when I was in school, when you was in school. They just want to be loved. They just need a kick in the pants, and they just need somebody to believe in them. Mm-hmm. And when I find that when I just build that relationship first, and I show them that they know that I care. They know that I'm there because I love them. I mean, I really do. I really do love them. And when they realize that I'm willing to have conversations with them, talk to them about football, talk to them about, you know, Beyonce or Kendrick Lamar, whatever. And they know I'm old. I'm 45. I don't know. Can't even understand what he's saying. But, like, I'm willing to engage with them. Then they're like, okay, they let their guard down. And then that's when you can really teach them. Mm.
I love your approach to teaching. Mark, what do you got?
Nothing. I'm just, you know, I mean, he's kind of spot on with a lot of the things that I would, you know, hope that are out there, especially with the program for, you know, for our young Black youth. I think it's promising. I think it's something that should be looked into a lot more because we need these programs and we need them to continue because I tell you, it's not going to get any easier. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we got to have these programs out there.
You know, absolutely. Because Wendell, I know you know this. And when you say, when these children start opening up to you and they are able to trust you, you find some hidden gems, don't you?
Maybe they're all hidden gems.
Whoa.
Like mm-hmm. like the song says, black diamonds and pearls. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like that's what they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, we can worry about, you know, like we can worry about the Rothschilds and the Bernsteins and the all these other people saying they're the chosen people. They're not the chosen people. That's Pookie and Ray Ray and LaQuisha and them. That's the chosen people.
Yeah, I got you.
They're the chosen. You know, I mean, nobody else in history fits the description like these kids. The slavery, the conditions they live in, the faith that they have inherited from their ancestors and that they have built on their own. These kids, they will eventually rule the world, either in my lifetime, my son's lifetime, or my grandkids' lifetime. They're going to basically remove all of this hoorah-rah stuff that we see going on, it's going to be gone. And right. they're going to be the ones to do it.
You know, we all are positive of our environment. And a lot of these children are coming in from a negative, even it could be even at home, you know?
Yeah.
And many parents have made the mistake, well, you're just like your daddy. You're not going to be any good. You know, I'm going to leave you because I'm, I can't put up with this. And that has an impact on the children. I believe that, doctor. And when you come in, now you still hold the authority. You're the authority in the room. However, how do you find it affects them and the communication? And do you find yourself bridging that communication gap? Because they're able to trust you and you're not coming from a negative point of view.
Two things I'll say about that is you're right that